Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Ed Wood's Plan 9 from Outer Space is often described as the worst movie ever made. But if you read film critic Catherine Coldiron's book, Junk Films, Why Bad Movies Matter, you just might change your mind. Or not. Catherine makes the case that bad movies do indeed matter. As she points out, we can learn a lot about filmmaking by watching bad movies and noticing their flaws. Catherine has put an incredible amount of thought into bad movies, and she writes beautifully and thoughtfully about them. Her fellow film critic, Ty Burr, describes Catherine's book as a smart and sneakily subversive read from a cultural critic with a magpie's eye for glittering swill.
I recently had to talk about the movie Toys from 1992, and a friend was continually defending it to me and saying, you know, there's this good quality and this good quality. And I realized that the way that I was looking at it was the perspective that I used in the book, which is this holographic, here's what I know about filmmaking to help dissect why this movie has failed for me. And that's a much easier way to look at a movie that I consider junk than a movie that's just bad. Like, a movie that's bad fails in these sort of ordinary ways that you can talk about and think about with the text of the film. But a junk film requires a more three-dimensional approach, a way to look at it that uses this theory of, well, we've got to look at the circumstances of its making and the amount of money that was spent and the talent of the director and the screenwriter and all these different circumstances, not just did this succeed or fail as a text.
Interesting. Let's talk about Ed Wood's sci-fi horror movie Plan 9 from Outer Space. You devote a lot of space to this movie. Many critics consider it to be the worst movie ever made. What is the single biggest problem with Plan 9, in your opinion?
I don't know. The single biggest problem, I mean, that's the issue with Plan 9, is that everything about it goes wrong. There's not one single failure unless it's the man behind the camera. It's like asking what's the one biggest great thing about Citizen Kane. I mean, you can't name one thing that makes Citizen Kane the standout film. It's Plan 9 is an extraordinary record of everything possible going wrong.
Mm-hmm. And is that the appeal? Is that why it continues to be like a fairly popular junk film, if that's fair to say?
I mean, I think it's a lot more watchable than a lot of bad movies, and a lot of the unintentional humor holds up over time.
What do you think will be the next obstacle the Earth people will put in our way?
Well, as long as they can think, we'll have our problems. But those whom we're using cannot think. They are the dead, brought to assimilated life by our electrode guns. You know, it's an interesting thing when you consider the Earth people who can think are so frightened by those who cannot, the dead. Well, our ship should be regenerated. We better get started.
It's enjoyable and it's passionate and it's not cynical. You know, a cynical movie, you're going to turn that off. It's not going to be fun. And the ways that it goes wrong are endlessly entertaining, timelessly so.
Very well said. So how many times have you watched Plan 9 from Outer Space?
Dozens, easily. I did watch it over and over and over when I was writing.
Yeah. There are so many movies and there's only so much time you have. Do you ever kind of think when you're rewatching and rewatching a film, do you think, geez, I'm missing out on a lot of other films? Or does that not really cross your mind? Is that not something to worry about?
I mean, I hugely appreciate the reminder of my mortality. That's really sweet of you.
Thank you.
I think this is what was given to me to do as a critic. It's to write about bad movies. I've tried writing about good movies, and those essays just don't sell as well. So for whatever reason, this is the specialty that I am bound to. And that means that I don't think that it's a waste of time to watch bad movies. Also, I will say that bad movies go wrong in so many different ways that watching a lot of them will teach you as much about cinema as watching a bunch of good movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I apologize. I didn't mean to say that you were wasting your time by watching bad
films. I didn't take it that way.
Yeah, okay, good. Yeah, good. You say that bad movies are, quote, wonderfully surprising because they upend audience expectations, unquote. Can you give us an example?
I can. Neil Breen, who is a very idiosyncratic director of terrible movies, released his most recent film. And in the middle of it, the main character goes walking in this field and he meets a woman dressed in these very floaty garments. And she transforms into a white tiger. And there is absolutely no reason for this to happen. There's no precedent for it. There's no sensible, symbolic anything to do with this. And so the audience that I was with, we all just screamed in delight because not only was the CG incredibly bad, and that was funny, but also just the way that this unexpected thing had happened, this turn in the film that none of us could have predicted, it was so delightful. And I can't remember the last time something happened in a mainstream American film that made me feel as delighted as that moment.
Mm. Yeah, and you say in your book, you say, ask me about him in person and we can talk for hours. Now, we're not quite in person, but we're virtual. Is there anything you can say that you'd be willing to say, or would you prefer not to?
I don't wish Neil Breen ill, but I also don't want to get sued. I think he is a fascinating filmmaker. Whatever he's doing, much like William Shatner, whatever he's doing, it's art. Hmm. And whether it's good art or bad art is for other people to say. Anyone who watches the films will have an opinion on that. I think that among contemporary filmmakers, you get the strongest sense of who he is, as opposed to a lot of filmmakers who kind of don't let their insecurities and anxieties out on the celluloid. Neil Breen is definitely, like, he has a God complex. That is absolutely apparent. And could you know that about Christopher Nolan by watching one of his films? I don't think so. I don't know if we get an idea of his psychology as well as we do with Neil Breen. There's an individual vision going on the film, and that's something I can say for sure about him.
Yeah, okay. I figured you would, yeah. You included Stephen Bochco's Cop Rock in your book, and it's a TV show as opposed to a film. Do you think there's a difference between junk TV and junk films?
Oh, yeah, definitely, definitely. Particularly in late 20th century television compared to early 21st century television, huge difference because television was birthed so differently and its purposes are so different than cinema that there's just no comparison. But Cop Rock is a unique work of late 20th century art, and I just couldn't leave it out. I had so much fun writing about it and thinking about it and introducing it to people that there was just no way I wouldn't, you know, I would fail to write about it. I had to.
Yeah. Yeah, and you were right to do that. You were compelled to, legally mandated almost. I'm so glad you did write about it because it's fascinating. Bochco, of course, had previously created the hit Hill Street Blues, also L.A. Law and Doogie Howser, M.D., which was Neil Patrick Harris's big break. What did you think of Cop Rock when you discovered it?
I'll tell you, I did not believe that it was real. Then I think this is a common reaction when people hear about Cop Rock. A friend of mine posted a video, it was Let's Be Careful Out There, of one of the musical numbers from Cop Rock on Facebook. And I looked at it and I went, okay, what is this? Did College Humor make this? No, it's too old. Is this some kind of Saturday Night Live? No, it's too earnest. What the hell is this? And so I looked it up. And upon looking it up, I went, oh my God, what a treasure. Cop Rock is a failed experiment in shoving together two very disparate genres, the musical and the police procedural. Both of those genres are pretty well defined. And putting them together, you have to have someone at the head of that who really understands both of those genres. Bochco fully understood the police procedural. I mean, he didn't invent it, but he went a long way toward developing it as we know it now. Whereas he didn't understand the musical at all. You got to tread lightly if you're going to put together especially very well-defined genres to stick them together. I remember when Zombieland did horror with, I guess, a kind of satirical comedy, and that worked out, but those two genres were a little bit looser. When you put together something like a sci-fi and a Western, I mean, this fella, he really does understand genre work very well, but some people try to shove genres together that haven't naturally gone together, and they don't understand enough about genre studies to really make it work. And Bochco, unfortunately, fell victim to that.
Very well said. Cop Rock was canceled after 11 episodes. Can you tell us about the series finale?
Oh, boy. It kind of has to be seen to be believed, because for, you know, 90% of it, it's just a normal episode of Cop Rock. They have, much like any Bochco procedural, the story is continuous over the course of the season. And you've got all these different storylines that kind of come together. And so you follow this guy, and then you follow this lady, and then you follow. And so the final episode does that for a while. And then there's this final scene where these two characters get in a room on the set, and they talk about being canceled.
I can't believe they canceled us.
Yeah, I know. I only got to sing one song.
Two.
Excuse me, one.
No, two. You sang that one song here in the office, what do you call it? How to Love a Woman, and the song in the dream sequence where they hang me in my underwear.
Yeah, but that wasn't my song, that was Carl's.
Oh, you still got to sing in it. I only got one song the whole time.
Well, you're not really a singer.
What do you mean I'm not really a singer? I started in this business as a singer.
Up until now, we've seen these characters be in character, but now they seem to be doing some kind of middle ground where their characters, you know, costumes and everything, but they're talking about, it's so weird. And then they sing this song, the whole cast gets on stage and they sing this song about having been canceled. They sing about Heaven's Gate, the movie, in this final song. It's bizarre. It's beyond belief.
Yeah, it's very meta, too.
Oh, yeah, it's like, extremely metatextual, but, like, in a failed way?
Yes.
Because it's not a delight for anybody? I don't know.
Yeah. No conversation about junk films would be complete, in my opinion, without talking about the indie horror movie Deathbed, The Bed That Eats. What's your take on this film?
Oh, Deathbed is great. Deathbed is amazing. I wanted to write about it because it's reasonably famous as a name of a bad movie. And Patton Oswalt did a routine involving Deathbed. And I think it came to people's attention with that.
This guy wrote Deathbed, The Bed That Eats People, took it to a second guy and said, okay, it's called Deathbed, The Bed That Eats People. Now the backstory is, there's a demon, and then the second guy said, stop drilling, you hit oil. You had me at Deathbed.
As I watched the movie and prepared to write about it, I realized it was actually a good movie. And there were things that I could point to and say, you know, this is not done that well. This is a little bit amateur, blah, blah, blah. But again, the more I watched it, the more I went, okay, but the cinematography is super interesting. The filmmaker made this limitation work for him. This is a little iffy, but it kind of works because of that. This is something I've never seen before. The more I watched it, the more it came across as a good film, and I could no longer continue to deny that, and so in the book, I defend it.
And it's a film you recommend to people, right?
Oh, absolutely, yes. And it's a wonderful little 70s art house horror piece.
What was the biggest challenge you faced while you were writing Junk Film?
The truth is, the hardest part of the book was finding someone to publish it. While I was writing it, the hardest thing was figuring out a coherent philosophy for how all of these essays went together. It couldn't just be that it was all bad films. It couldn't just be that it was all unusual oddities from the junkyard. How do I eliminate films from this list? How do I choose which movies to write about? And some people have asked me if there are any movies that I wish I had written about in this book, and there are a couple. But I figured if I opened it up any further than the ones that I knew I wanted to write about, then I would never stop writing this book and it would never be finished. But yeah, the challenge was really in finding some. I knew that this book had an audience, but I couldn't convince any publishers to agree with me about that.
That's surprising and disappointing. That makes me think that publishers are more conservative than I think.
I have a lot of opinions on that, but... This
Do you want
to
share
show.
Any of them? Yeah, okay, there you go. So, yeah. Yeah. If you were to recommend two junk films to our listeners besides Deathbed, we're not including that one, which two would you choose?
For adult audiences, I would say Switchblade Sisters, which is an amazing, amazing movie. And kind of in that line, I would say some of Jack Hill's other work. So, Switchblade Sisters. The work of Russ Meyer is something like I kind of want to write a whole book just about Russ Meyer because he directed Faster Pussycat Kill Kill, which is a terrific movie.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to violence, the word and the act. While violence cloaks itself in a plethora of disguises, its favorite mantle still remains sex.
And he also directed Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, which has nothing to do really with Valley of the Dolls. It's a sequel, but not right. really.
Yeah, and co-written by Roger Ebert, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes, which is interesting, yeah.
It's a fascinating film. Russ Meyer is a fascinating filmmaker. Baz Luhrmann kind of stole his whole shtick from
Russ Meyer. Yeah, I haven't thought of that, but you're right.
Which blows me away. It depends on what the viewer wants, because if they want just like a bad schlocky movie, then I have one set of recommendations. If they want to think more about how junk film comes and goes in our culture, then I was going to recommend one of the teenagers' films, because those films are from the 1940s, and they kind of demonstrate how cinema comes and then is consigned to the dustbin and we forget all about it. But that's a sort of more philosophical stance than watching Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Yeah. Very well said. Catherine Coldiron, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on Junk Film, Why Bad Movies Matter.
Thank you.
Catherine Coldiron is the author of Junk Film, Why Bad Movies Matter. Find out more at wpr.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Alexis Solosky, Denny Tedesco, and Catherine Coldiron.
What you're gleaning from these interviews is groundbreaking.
Beta is available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. Don't forget to offer a rating or to share with new alphas. And you can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
The only spirits he saw tonight were those I smelled on his breath.
Our executive producer, nay showrunner, is Adam Friedrich.
You know, I'll bet my badge right now, we haven't seen the last of those weirdies.
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future.